But I'm going to talk a little bit about some of that pixie dust here at the beginning, and I want you to, you know, come with me down the road a little bit, because the code of conduct oftentimes has been in the hands of us in the legal department, and it's a document that can be much broader and have implications on the culture of the organization, can have a real effect on building an ethical culture or rebuilding a culture in an organization that's had some failures. I know that's true because I've been doing it long enough now for the last few years to see that happen with organizations that have really taken advantage of the opportunities beyond just having a code of conduct that meets requirements. And that's traditionally what the code was. It was a document so that you could get listed on the exchange because it was a requirement to be listed on NASDAQ or NYSE. That's where it came from. But it's much more than that now, and I want you to suspend your disbelief on some of those more aspirational things and take off your lawyer hat a little bit on a couple of those items. And that's in this first part where we talk about the purposes of the code. Lest we forget our friends at the Department of Justice, they also have been talking in this aspirational tone about code of conduct for the last few years. If you've been reading the non-prosecution and deferred prosecution agreements that have been coming out for the last decade that insist on compliance and ethics reforms in organizations that have had failures, or if you've read the resource guide for FCPA, which I'm quoting here, or any of the myriad of speeches that Leslie Caldwell, who's the current head of the criminal division, or Andrew Wiseman, who's the head of the fraud section, go out on the stump and speak about corporate malfeasance, they talk about code of conduct and they talk about culture. They talk in this aspirational tone.